Orchestra of Spheres.
Broadcasting from Foothill College.
Broadcasting from Foothill College.
This is KFJC.
This is KFJC.
Los Altos Hills.
Los Altos Hills.
Broadcasting from.
Broadcasting from.
Foothill College.
Foothill College.
This is JFJKS.
Is it with an S on the end?
Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and in this segment we're going to begin our examination of the remarkable new book Blood Oath by Stephen Wirth, W-O-R-T-H, and Carl Jaspers, J-A-S-P-E-R-S, subtitled The Conspiracy to Murder Nicole Brown Simpson. This book was just published in softcover by Rainbow Books, copyright 1996. The ISBN number is 1-56825-058-4. This book is about an alleged conspiracy. I suspect this book is accurate in the vast bulk of its information, but the final confirmation has yet to come. I think this book is right on the money, although a few details may be disinformation. The authors hold open that possibility. This book is about a white supremacist plot to murder Nicole Brown Simpson, to frame O.J. Simpson for the murder, and in turn to use this event to divide the races in the United States, to discredit and alter the judicial system, and to discredit law enforcement, the LAPD in particular, and also to polarize law enforcement officers and to recruit them into the white supremacist camp. I'm going to begin by reading the author's prologue and how they came to access this particular story via an informant who, like all of the other participants in this elite white supremacist strike team, is identified only by a code name. By the way, listeners to this segment should contact Spitfire and get a hold, and in fact they will be provided with our interview with Stephen Wirth that should precede this particular series of half-hour segments taken from the book Blood Oath. Blood Oath, The Conspiracy to Murder Nicole Brown Simpson, begins with the following prologue explaining how the authors came to this story. This story begins, as does the story of the murders themselves, far from the grisly scene where Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Lyle Goldman were brutally slain. It all began months after the killings in a small, quiet community nestled safely within the rolling hills of Westchester County, inside the borders of New York State, where I, Stephen Wirth, was engrossed in the day-to-day operation of a small corporation. 2,500 miles away, my co-author Carl Jaspers, a freelance writer, consultant, and ex-magazine columnist, was living and working in Los Angeles, California, the city of angels and of demons. Our on-and-off collaboration on various projects had spanned a period of 15 years. A strange combination of luck and fate brought us together to work on this book, our latest project. It all began during a busy lunch hour on Monday, April 24th, 1995. A telephone caller wanted to know if I was in the office that day. About an hour later, a plain manila envelope addressed to my true identity without a return address was delivered. It has been left just inside the side door of the building that housed my offices. The envelope contained a Los Angeles Times front page article dated July 16th, 1993, and a note that claimed its author was responsible for the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman. I had been fascinated by the Brown-Goldman murder case as it unfolded, especially the swirling controversies that were starting to surround the various pieces of evidence, their locations, and how some of the evidence got to where it was found. In researching the subject, I contacted O.J.'s defense team and various city agencies, including the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office, Los Angeles Police Department, or LAPD, the mayor's office, and several Los Angeles newspapers. It is highly likely that a person in one of these offices or a person intercepting their calls had passed my name and phone number on to an interested third party. The note, cut and pasted from newsprint, read, "Too many innocents have died. Oklahoma City is the latest. More is yet to come. I heard you are a writer. I have a story to tell. I helped frame O.J. Simpson and kill Nicole Brown and Ron Goldman. I will contact you again." The caption of the article read, "Alleged white supremacists seized an assassination plot. Crime, Rodney King, First AME Church were among targets of at least one suspect, investigators say. Agents tracked Southland's hate group's activities for 18 months, leading to the 8 arrests. A reproduction of the complete front-page article is included in the appendices, copied from the original. At 10 minutes to 5 that afternoon, a man with a deep, raspy voice that sounded as though it had been ruined by cigarettes called. Without offering pleasantries, he asked me if I was interested in his story. Receiving a qualified yes, he directed me to take the envelope and note he had delivered along with a pad of paper and a pen to a payphone a couple of blocks away. If I wanted the story, I would have to be there in 5 minutes to receive another call. Thus began one of the most bizarre collaborations in the history of American journalism apart from Watergate. I was being handed my own deep throat informant. The crime was the O.J. Simpson murders. During the first conversation, the informant rambled on about his reasons for wanting to talk. In spite of his ramblings, he didn't seem stupid. On the contrary, he seemed to be quite an intelligent and well-informed man. However, he did seem nervous and agitated. He said he wanted to establish some ground rules so he could feel more comfortable about what he had to do. At the end of the call, he asked me to leave the envelope and note on top of the payphone. The informant was obsessed with concealing his identity. He didn't bother to offer an alias. I assigned him the code name Skinner so I could address him by name. Skinner liked his new name, chuckling that it fit his personality. His cryptic fashioning of the message piqued my curiosity. When I inquired why the Denver Post was included on the note, Skinner responded just as cryptically, quote, "In time, it will become self-evident," unquote. He became agitated when I pressed him further and would offer nothing else. Skinner's ramblings in that first conversation are summarized and presented in Chapter 4 from notes taken that day. Subsequent conversations are summarized in succeeding chapters. Wherever possible, as part of the agreement with the informant, his words are presented verbatim with little editing. To meet this goal, Skinner agreed to allow the taping of his conversations, but with an all-important caveat. Skinner's voice flowed through the receiver like a cold, icy wind. Quote, "Tape our conversations, turn the voice into written words, then destroy the tape. Don't reuse the tape or make copies. Each session will require a new tape and the destruction of the earlier one. A voice analyzer will be used to check your responses to my inquiries on this matter. Don't ever forget my blood oath, reprinted on page 3 before the preface of this book," unquote. By the way, the blood oath is the oath of the Bruderschweigen, or Silent Brotherhood. That is the American Nazi organization that evolved from the Order, founded by Robert J. Matthews. More about that later on in this discussion, and of which this elite white supremacist strike team, and we're going to talk about its name, was an outgrowth. The oath is, "Let me bear witness to you, my brothers, that should an enemy of our cause, whether he be from within or from without, and cause hurt to you, I will chase him to the ends of the earth and remove his head from his body." That's the oath that members of this organization apparently had to take, and that members of the Order did as well. And again, the informant, Skinner, informed Stephen Wirth and his co-author that he should not ever forget that oath. Continuing with the narrative, "I knew two things for a certainty. One, voice analyzers existed, and two, I wasn't going to cross him. His last 6 words still haunt me. I raced back to my office and called my co-author, the perennial bachelor, who was just leaving for a 9 p.m. screening of the previous weekend's smash hit film, While You Were Sleeping. He was intrigued. Less than a year before, he had sat transfixed on the San Diego freeway trying to drive south. All traffic had stopped while a white Ford Bronco headed in the opposite direction sped toward Brentwood at 55 miles per hour with what seemed like dozens of police cars in pursuit. The shoulders of the freeway were lined with cars cheering the Bronco on. Fans and banners that proclaimed, quote, 'We love O.J.,' unquote, hung from the railings of overpasses. At the wheel was Al Cowlings. Crouched down in the back seat was O.J. himself. It was rumored he had a loaded gun, a passport, and $10,000 in cash. My co-author remembered thinking it was quite a spectacle. He never dreamed he would be asked to jump into the middle of the O.J. controversy 10 months later. When I told him about the informant, he didn't have to think. He suggested we go for it and canceled his plans for the evening. Together we discussed Skinner and the believability of his story. We made tentative plans to proceed with a jointly written book if Skinner's story held up. The division of labor was worked out. I would talk to Skinner, take notes, and perform preliminary research of the facts using the many sides of OJ-related material available through online services and on the Internet. Based on my notes and preliminary research, I would pound out a rough first draft, which I would then fax and or upload chapter by chapter to my co-author in L.A. His role would then be to dig deeper into the details of Skinner's story, to make sure they were possible as only someone in Los Angeles could do, and to reorganize my draft and rewrite it. Somehow, Skinner had learned that I traveled a lot. In fact, I was almost constantly on the road. Consequently, he insisted on telling his story to me via the phone at different locations around the country that corresponded with my prearranged travel. It was a test of perseverance. Skinner was not going to make it easy. He called me at the hotels in which I was staying. The times varied, but they were predominantly at night. He had to be the one making the calls. I could not call him. Instead, I received the calls at payphones in the hotel lobbies. I had no idea how Skinner obtained the numbers of these phones. He must have had help from someone within the various telephone companies involved. The states in which I received calls included New York, Texas, Utah, Nebraska, Maryland, and more. I began to feel I was being watched. He called me every few days over the next 8 weeks. On the phone, he insisted on doing most of the talking, often for over an hour or more, rarely letting me get a question in edgewise. He always seemed on the verge of hanging up, which he did a number of times when he felt like it. At the end of his story, the call stopped. We have not heard from our informant since mid-July of 1995. Skinner told a grand story, frequently losing himself in the drama of what he was saying, telling his story in the dramatic and often pretentious cliched language. He often took the parts of the different characters he talked about. From time to time, he seemed to be imitating the voices of these people. Although he used their voices, he would never give them names. He would prompt me to suggest additional code names, giving me feedback on how close I came to capturing their personalities. True to his word, he checked the status of the previous tapes, and true to our word, we destroyed them. From the beginning, the informant seemed to be having fun with us, and we didn't trust him or his story. We felt manipulated like pawns, and often talked about ending our strange chessboard dance. Instead, a little voice inside one or the other always told us to hang in there a little longer. As authors, we threw ourselves into researching the facts Skinner had revealed. We did this primarily as a salve, hoping to soothe what first seemed like a severe case of gullibility. By the way, I would add that, as you will see, I would not describe Skinner's language as pretentious, although I understand why the authors described it that way. Rather, I would describe it as the language of a true believer. And even though, as we shall see, Skinner relented concerning the crimes he had allegedly been involved in, nonetheless, he remained steadfastly true to his fellow white supremacist comrades and did not want to reveal their identities. So again, I would not describe his language as cliched or pretentious, although I can understand why the authors used those words. Rather, I would describe his language as the language of a true believer. Beginning again with this last paragraph. From the beginning, the informant seemed to be having fun with us, and we didn't trust him or his story. We felt manipulated like pawns, and often talked about ending our strange chessboard dance. Instead, a little voice inside one or the other always told us to hang in there a little longer. As authors, we threw ourselves into researching the facts that Skinner had revealed. We did this primarily as a salve, hoping to soothe what at first seemed like a severe case of gullibility. As Skinner's story and our research progressed, we began to recognize too many coincidences between his words, the slayings in Los Angeles, and the events described in the articles and reports we were researching to dismiss any of it lightly. We read extensively about the slayings and the case against O.J., reading every page of grand jury and trial testimony. Taking advantage of my interest in such organizations as the Anti-Defamation League, the Jewish Defense League, and Klan Watch, we found and read their reports and talked to whomever at these organizations would talk to us. reports of government commissions, national and local, concerned with the white supremacy movement and violence were ordered and read. A picture of a sordid underbelly of contemporary American culture began to emerge. We gradually came to believe that we no longer had a choice. There was a good possibility O.J. was framed, and in the way the informant described. We began to realize this book had to be written, regardless of our dislike and initial distrust of the informant. We also questioned our personal safety. Even though Skinner assured us that no harm would come to us when the book was published, we had our doubts. He insisted that the group of which he was a part knew that writers had their job to do, and that they would come after him, not us, for breaking his oath. And that is the basic thrust of how the authors came by the story of the conspiracy, or the alleged conspiracy, to murder Nicole Brown Simpson to frame O.J. Simpson. By the way, one of the conditions that their informant imposed was that 10% or more of the proceeds of the book be donated to a fund for to assist the victims of the Oklahoma City bombing. And it was Skinner's contention that the same elite underground, white supremacist underground, was responsible for the Oklahoma City bombing. We should note that the informant had apparently had extensive combat experience in Vietnam, and that after Oklahoma City, he began to have the Vietnam-related nightmares that he had previously had, and the carnage at Oklahoma City, plus the apparent loss, or at least according to him, the loss of some of his kinsmen, which is a term he uses to refer to his fellow white supremacists, this led him to relent about what he had been participating in. And so he basically decided to come clean and break the story, although he was, again, steadfastly loyal to his white supremacist comrades in arms. By the way, the address for the fund for the victims of the Oklahoma City bombing: the Mayor's Office, the Mayor's Disaster Relief Fund, 200 West Walker, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, 73102. Now, the informant maintained to the authors, Stephen Wirth and Carl Jaspers, that one of the operations that this group had been in, by the way, the group's name was CAUSE, standing for Christian Aryan Underground Special Enforcers, and this was an elite white supremacist team, as we shall see, composed of people with extraordinary military and law enforcement credentials in their pedigrees, that was put together to not only unite various white supremacist groups in this country, but to unite them in a program of combat, covert operations, and psychological operations, as we shall see. One of the incidents that they were apparently involved in, or allegedly involved in, according to Skinner, was the murder of a music producer named Brett Cantor. During the course of the O.J. Simpson trial, O.J.'s defense attorneys and also a few journalists pointed out the similarities between the way in which Ron Goldman and Nicole Brown had been murdered, and the methodology in the unsolved murder of a music producer and nightclub owner named Brett Cantor, C-A-N-T-O-R, who was an acquaintance, by the way, of several of the principals in the case itself, meaning O.J., Nicole, and I believe Ron also. It is the contention of Skinner that some of his CAUSE compatriots murdered Brett Cantor when he refused to promote a white supremacist rock band named Rahowa, R-A-H-O-W-A, standing for Racial Holy War. In Blood Oath, we see a description of, or we read a description of Brett Cantor's murder, or a recounting of Brett Cantor's murder as follows. Talking after discussing the impending operation against Nicole Brown Simpson, codenamed Operation Thunderbolt, we read, "Damn," quote, this is quoting one of the white supremacists in CAUSE, codenamed the Enforcer, quote, "Damn, that's my kind of action. I can still see the look on that music promoter's face when we slit his throat, but not before we made a pincushion out of him. That Jew Cantor shouldn't have badmouthed the Rahowa band and trashed the music we wanted him to promote. I think it was about 2:30 in the morning that we put him to sleep in his bedroom," unquote, sneered the Enforcer. Quote, That was one more insignificant Jew we got in July. This time, we'll send a message to all who defy our ultimate goal of a pure white race. We can take a lesson from the Silent Brotherhood. Mulnix was the investigative chief who examined the murder scene of the Jew Berg. Mulnix said he'd seen everything from muggings to gangland slayings, but never saw anyone butchered the way Berg had been. So again, one of the operations that this group had allegedly been involved in was the murder of Brett Kanter for refusing to promote the Rahowa white supremacist band. It is also the contention of Skinner that this group had also been involved in the planning of a bombing of the AME Church, and not only the bombing, but the massacre of the parishioners of the AME Church in Los Angeles. A recounting of that allegation also is relayed or recounted in the book Blood Oath. We read, "For months after our failure to destroy the first AME, African Methodist Episcopal Church of Los Angeles, and its congregation in June of 1993, my kinsmen, the members of the newly formed cause, couldn't stop talking about it. We dissected the operation from every angle, discussing it over and over. Then, just as suddenly, our talk began to shift to an upcoming anniversary. Our leadership realized that although cause was growing in numbers, we needed to accelerate this growth tenfold to achieve our dream of a white nation within the United States. A major division between the races had to be achieved. The time was right in society. A simmering undercurrent of distrust had once again risen between the races." And again, it talks about race riots that occurred in various American cities in the 1960s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. Skipping down still further, "The fires of the L.A. riots were out, but we all knew the embers of hatred were still hot to the touch. We were sure that the least bit of fanning would turn those glowing embers into a roaring fire, a fire which would consume any bit of goodwill that had been established between the races. I remember very clearly the meeting where it all began. It was Saturday, the 9th of October, 1993, a very special day to those of us who were believers in Odinism. It had been ordered by the Christian Aryan Underground Special Enforcers, CAUSE, our newly formed militant arm. Its members were the elite of several groups which the authorities had called, quote, disjointed white supremacists, unquote. We laughed about how the CAUSE had now become the country's worst nightmare. Joe Allen be damned." That, by the way, refers to an FBI informant who had helped to frustrate the plot against the AME Church. "The authorities had been warned about us. They heard unconfirmed rumors that attempts were being made to create a combined unified force of racist white supremacists cooperating with organized violent militia. What made this group far more dangerous than any group before it was that it had unlimited financial assistance from a foreign terrorist group." More about that still later in this particular discussion. Skipping down still further, "The enforcer told me about some of the planning for operations that had failed. They were bombings and killings that had been designed to ignite a race war by targeting highly visible niggers." And again, I'm using the terminology that Skinner uses here, so please forgive my use of strong language. I'm trying to present the verisimilitude of this particular account. "They were to be the flint that would ignite already highly combustible feelings. The actions had far-reaching support, but the cooperation between the groups involved was inadequate. The enforcer recalled how a semi-coordinated operation to assassinate Rodney King and destroy the first African Methodist Episcopal Church in Los Angeles by the Fourth Reich Skinheads, or FRS, along with similar attempts in Oregon, had been discovered and aborted in July. The enforcer ended his story with a string of curse words and then, quote, this was the perfect illustration of what happens when a small group, unskilled in the planning necessary to carry out a coordinated action, gets impatient and decides to independently accomplish the task. They F it up, unquote. The leadership of the cause felt that the original plan for the action was admirable, create an atmosphere where race riots would flourish with impunity. Another founding member, codenamed the Discoverer, overheard the comments and chimed in, quote, the concept and its implementation failed because it lacked the military secrecy required and the necessary strategic alliances. The lack of a stringent security system permitted infiltration of their ranks. Background investigations would have eliminated from a position of confidence the FBI agent who infiltrated the group. He wouldn't have been able to gain access to critical data. As it was, we finally did penetrate his cover with the help of one of our Oklahoma City brethren. They're real sharp. We're going to do something together with them real soon. But his unmasking came too late, only 3 days before the FBI arrests. The plan did not fail because the FRS lacked weapons or dedicated followers. Its failure can be traced to Joe Allen, a Judas of the worst kind. He's just like the other Judas Martinez who helped the authorities capture and kill some of our people, those gallant members of the order. The ability of another Judas to corrupt the outcome of a planned action was an embarrassment to our cause. This will no longer be tolerated. That's why we made the decision to establish the cause. We have taken measures so that the cause cannot be infiltrated by traitors to the white race like those who infest the authoritarian establishment at all levels, unquote. We were all sure that a unification of white supremacist organizations with a council of only the three most loyal members of each member group would guarantee no more infiltration and embarrassment. It would also allow us to successfully pull off our 10-year anniversary celebration of Alan Berg's death. Again, Alan Berg was the Denver talk show host who was assassinated by the Order, the militant Nazi organization that was a spinoff of the Church of Jesus Christ Christian, the Aryan Nations group that is headquartered in Hayden Lake. Eventually, that group was brought to heel by law enforcement members. However, the full roster, I guess one could say, of the Order was never fully taken stock of or brought in. And it's pretty evident, at least if one can believe the account presented here, that that type of operation and indeed that milieu has proceeded to grow and prosper. So again, according to Skinner's allegations, Operation Thunderbolt, the murder of Nicole Brown Simpson and the framing of O.J. Simpson, was intended to, among other things, at least in terms of, at least in temporal terms, to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the murder of Alan Berg. Several things to call attention to. First of all, the founding member of CAUSE, codenamed Discoverer, talks about the need to implement strict military security and strategic alliances. He also talks about the assistance that this group apparently received, at least according to the account presented here, from one of their, quote, Oklahoma City brethren, and also talks about doing something together with them real soon. According to Skinner, the Oklahoma City operation was pulled off by this particular group, which apparently has infiltrated to a considerable extent many of the militia groups and Patriots networks as well. As I've indicated in the past, those groups are not coterminous by any means with Nazis or white supremacists. Many of the people in those groups are sincere patriots and very fine people, or even a few liberals in some of the militia groups. However, at the same time, there is a very dark underbelly to some of those groups, and I am personally critical of the lack of recognition or understanding on the part of many of the militia groups and the Patriots networks of the very virulent Nazi and fascist elements within their ranks. So some of them, according to Skinner, apparently pulled off Oklahoma City, and it was guilt over Oklahoma City plus his recurring Vietnam nightmares due to the Oklahoma City carnage and the slaughter of Ron and Nicole that prompted his change of heart. That concludes this segment. We're going to continue with our presentation of the very important and chilling book, Blood Oath, on the other side of this cassette. Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in this segment we're going to continue with readings from a new book called Blood Oath by Stephen Wirth and Carl Jaspers. That is subtitled The Conspiracy to Murder Nicole Brown Simpson. It's published in softcover by Rainbow Books, copyright 1996. This book is about an alleged, and I say alleged because the information comes from an anonymous informant, an alleged white supremacist conspiracy to murder Nicole Brown Simpson and to frame O.J. Simpson for the killings for reasons which we shall discuss. I personally suspect that this book is basically on the mark. However, even the authors believe that it's altogether possible that there may be some disinformation in this particular work. However, I think this book is basically the truth, with a capital T, concerning the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman. The fact of the matter is, and I'm not going to discuss the author's lengthy discussion of the phenomenal discrepancies in the state's case and in the physical evidence, what O.J. Simpson was alleged to have done is physically impossible. That has been my contention almost from the beginning of this case. For those doubting Thomases and doubting Thomasinas, there's a very good and lengthy discussion in this book about the numerous evidentiary anomalies and the many unaccountable aspects of the case, if one were to believe that O.J. Simpson was the perpetrator. I would note that he not only was acquitted, but a mock trial in Phoenix acquitted him as well. So, again, I think that it is evident that O.J. Simpson was framed, whoever may have done it. And my personal belief is that the story presented in Blood Oath is accurate in its... It is fundamentally accurate, although there may be some elements of disinformation. And in fact, the authors indicate that Skinner may have deliberately introduced some disinformation vis-a-vis some of the things that could have identified some of his Nazi comrades in arms, to whom he remains at least psychologically loyal, even though he recognizes that they will come after him and try to find him and kill him for having betrayed their cause. Nonetheless, I think that not only is this book almost certainly accurate in its in the bulk of its information, but I also want to underscore that many of the things that are presented in this book check out with other pieces of information that have come to light, and indeed the authors point that out as well, and we will discuss many of the points of intersection between Skinner's story. Skinner is the code name for the author's informant, and other things that can be verified from the media and the verifiable objective research. One of the points that I have made from the beginning about the O.J. Simpson case was my working hypothesis that the murders of Ron and Nicole and the framing of O.J. basically constituted a psyop, a type of intelligence operation known as a psychological operation. I have long suspected and still suspect the possibility of a degree of overlap between some of the elements involved in this and some elements of our own and perhaps other national security establishments as well. In a miscellaneous 8-segment series entitled Specialized Knowledge and Abilities, I discussed my suspicion that many of the terrorist incidents that have overtaken this country in recent months and years, as well as some of the incidents in Europe and elsewhere, were produced by fascist elements not only at the street level but with assistance from the inside of the political and national security establishments of their respective countries, and beyond that, that these fascist elements inside and outside of government are in league with each other around the world. And indeed, the story presented by Skinner would seem to confirm many of my suspicions presented in that series. We should note that the strike team of which Skinner was apparently a part was part of a small blind cell, and they did not know the other elements involved in this particular operation or who may have been above them. It would not surprise me one bit if that fascist elements within some of our intelligence services and or military, as well as fascist elements perhaps within the Republican Party itself, may have been part of the milieu of which the cause was a part. But again, with the strict cellular organization and a blind cellular structure that this organization, like many other fascist organizations, adhered to, it would be impossible for the members to know who their real controllers were. I suspect that people in positions of great power in this country may very well have been involved with this organization. That, however, is conjecture. The first element that we're going to discuss in discussing Operation Thunderbolt, the code name for this operation presented by Skinner, is the contention by Skinner that, in fact, this operation was indeed the Nazi psyop, the Nazi psychological operation that I have long maintained that it is. Now, this does not prove that my hypothesis was correct. However, I would point out that this is yet another contention of exactly what I've been saying, coming from a radically different source. In Chapter 5, entitled Skinner's Story, The Plan, we read the following. The plan for the anniversary celebration, by the way, the anniversary is the anniversary of the murder of Alan Berg by the Order. The plan for the anniversary celebration consisted of a plot so sinister, so creative, so diabolical that the outcome would provide for the embarrassment of an entire city, an entire race, and an entire nation. The plot included a well-thought-out action that could damage the U.S. judicial system forever. It would create a sense of doubt that would exist in every future trial. When we had all gathered in the farmhouse's spacious parlor, the Discoverer, by the way, each of the members of this elite Nazi strike team has a code name. None of them were identified to the authors by name, including their informant. So when you hear the Discoverer or Speedy or Thumper or the Blade or Skinner, these are all code names for the members of this team. Beginning again, when we had all gathered in the farmhouse's spacious parlor, the Discoverer continued to explain the rationale of the plan. Quote, "Evidence presented and testimony offered by law enforcement officers will be challenged forever from this case forward," unquote, he said. Still quoting, "It's a plan designed in part to be a payback for all those responsible for actions that have been carried out against freedom-loving white supremacists," unquote. Another founder of the cause picked up the explanation. Quote, "The plan is centered around an individual easily recognized and respected among blacks and whites. It will look like he's being framed by the authorities. The situation is designed to call upon and challenge interpersonal beliefs that every person holds. People will choose sides. Their consciences won't permit otherwise. The final coup will occur when our target is found guilty or his credibility is destroyed. This event will generate instant racial tension followed by violence. We're going to ensure that by fueling what will already be an inflamed situation. The plan will use the distrust between the authorities and the blacks that's existed in Los Angeles for years. At first, everyone will choose up sides. As the discussions become heated and clouded with rhetoric, violence will follow. After much destruction has occurred, the cause will then step forward to take credit for the framing. But it will be painfully obvious that we couldn't have done it without the help of an easily duped, overzealous prosecution," unquote. The leader of the cause meeting, codenamed the Deliverer, continued on with a grin that appeared to be etched in place. He was obviously enjoying his presentation. Strutting about in front of this select group, he described how this diabolic plan was offered to him as if from a sign from above, a sign designed to be passed down to his followers, the chosen Aryan race. By the way, the Deliverer is a former high-ranking military officer who is the contact man between this blind cell, this elite strike team, and those anonymous forces that were in the command structure that commanded them. By the way, it should be noted that other elements involved in this operation were unknown to the members of this blind cell. Pausing briefly, I want to point out that the use of small blind cells is a traditional methodology of underground fascist organizations. I've dealt with that in numerous archive shows, including Radio Free America 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War, and also a miscellaneous archive show from the fall of 1994 entitled Why Johnny Can't Identify Il Duce. Those are available from archives on audio. So again, note that one of the major goals of this particular operation was to split the races in preparation for a race war. We've discussed that in the previous segment on the previous side of this cassette. I also want to point out that in addition to alienating the races from each other and dividing and antagonizing black and white, this operation was intended to discredit the judicial system itself and to discredit law enforcement. As we shall see, white supremacist officers allied with cause were utilized in a big way for this operation, both to provide field-level intelligence to the elite strike team and also to direct the investigation in the direction of O.J. Simpson. Even though white supremacist elements loyal to this unit were, and within the L.A. legal system, were involved with the framing of O.J. Simpson, and even though other officers not necessarily connected with this organization further manufactured evidence to frame O.J. Simpson, We should note that law enforcement itself and the Los Angeles Police Department in particular were targets of this particular PSYOP. And again, this is, according to Skinner anyway, a Nazi PSYOP, just as I have long been saying. So again, the targets of this operation, I'm not talking about the individuals, but the goals to divide the races in preparation for a race war, which would lead to the ascension of the white supremacist movement in the United States, the discrediting and amending of the judicial system, and the discrediting and antagonizing of the LAPD and law enforcement in general. Again, this is a psychological operation. One of the things that the informant, codenamed Skinner, points out, or maintains, I should say, is that, in fact, the Furman tapes, the infamous Furman tapes recorded by Laura Hart McKinney, which obviously led to heightened tensions between the races, and which certainly discredited Mark Furman, and perhaps to a certain extent, by extension, the LAPD itself, at least in the eyes of minorities and open-minded people. These tapes, according to Skinner, were leaked to the defense by members of this organization. Skinner points out in the book that the mock trial in Phoenix, which had O.J. Simpson acquitted, had been closely monitored by elements, basically fascist-slash-Nazi-slash-white-supremacist elements, allied with the Patriots networks in Phoenix. The authors write of Skinner's contention. By the way, the generals here refers to the commanding officers of this operation within the white supremacist movement. They are unknown, their identities unknown to all except for the deliverer, again, the commander, a former high-ranking military officer of this elite strike team, and an individual who was the go-between between this blind cell and the generals and the other elements behind this organization. Returning to Blood Oath, we read, quote, "The generals were on top of the mock trial thanks to our local patriots in Phoenix. Yes, it's true what you just read, and the possibility of that outcome is being contemplated with an ingenious plan in the works. One way or another, we'll win," said was Margie's final statement. Margie, by the way, is the wife of the deliverer and a loyal participant in this particular operation. And again, this notes that in a mock trial in Phoenix, O.J. was found not guilty. And Margie's maintaining that the generals had taken this into account and had a stratagem in the works that would achieve their goal of, again, dividing and antagonizing the races, discrediting the judicial system, discrediting law enforcement in general and the LAPD in particular, and in turn heightening tensions between the officers of LAPD and the population, leading to greater recruitment of law enforcement officers by the white supremacist movement. It is the contention of Skinner that the leaking of the defense team's discovery of the Laura Hart McKinney tapes was leaked to them, or was the result of a leak that was generated, opened up, one could say, perhaps, by the elite cause strike team, precisely in order to heighten the tensions and discredit the institutions I've already discussed. The authors relate Skinner's account of this, quote, and this is quoting a member of the strike team called The Blade, a codenamed The Blade, I should say, the individual who actually wound up doing the killing of Ron and Nicole. Quote, "I'll answer that in a minute, but first some important news. A couple of days ago, I received word from the generals that they approved of the deliverer's ideas that will now turn the whole trial around. There are tapes of Detective Mark Furman describing how much he hates niggers and how he and other LAPD officers, as a matter of course, planted evidence in prior cases. We have leaked to the defense the existence of these tapes. If the defense can get their hands on these tapes, you'll see all hell break loose in a couple of weeks. The generals are convinced that this will drive an even bigger wedge between the races, inflaming both communities. The whites won't believe it. They'll see it as just another attack by the nigger lovers, while the hip-hop and black sambos will see the tapes as justifying what they've always known. The cops have stacked the deck against them and theirs. No questions, gentlemen. I'm not at liberty to say anything more. Besides, I don't know nothing. By the way, again, I want to apologize for the strong language here. I'm quoting the text verbatim, and apparently Skinner and the authors have gone to considerable length to recreate the verisimilitude of these particular events. I would also point out that it may be that the Trojan horse that is alluded to, and we'll get to that in just a few minutes, an insider within L.A. law enforcement who was involved with CAUSE and was part of Operation Thunderbolt may very well have been Mark Furman. That's not by any means established. That remains conjecture. It also may be that Dark German, as he is codenamed, might have been a composite of various officers within L.A. law enforcement. Indeed, it appears that this group had heavily and very successfully recruited from L.A. law enforcement. So again, the Dark German here is a codename once again for the ringer, so to speak, the Trojan horse that this CAUSE strike team had inside of L.A. law enforcement. And one of the suspicions I have, and co-author Stephen Wirth shares this suspicion, is that if, in fact, the Dark German does refer to Mark Furman, and that remains conjectural, that the infamous Furman tapes may have been the information that you're going to hear alluded to that would blow the lid off of the LAPD. Again, it's important to remember that in addition to black Americans, in addition to relations between blacks and whites, the judicial system itself and law enforcement in general and the LAPD in particular were among the targets of the operation, targeted for discreditation, targeted also for polarization and stratification, two words that I used frequently in my specialized knowledge and abilities series that I recorded last spring. Returning to Blood Oath, we read, and again, the Dark German is the code name presented here for the law enforcement LAPD Trojan horse that this Operation Thunderbolt utilized. Quote, "The Dark German can't wait for the hanging of this nigger. He's got some deep, dark secret he's told the deliverer that's guaranteed to blow the lid off the LAPD. The deliverer related to me the following, quote, "When they hear what I've got to say about their police department, they'll start something between the races that we'll finish once and for all. Maybe you know what he's talking about, Blade. He's from up in your neck of the woods." So again, it remains conjectural, but one of the possibilities that I think should be considered is that not only perhaps was the Dark German Mark Furman, or perhaps Furman and or other L.A. officers, but that perhaps the Furman tapes were this blockbuster that it's alluded to here, or this bombshell that would blow the lid off of the LAPD. And again, the contention is by members of this elite strike team, as presented by Skinner, a member of that team, that in fact the Furman tapes were leaked to the defense in order, again, to heighten racial tension and to discredit LAPD and the judicial system. One of the contentions by the deliverer, again, he's the former high-ranking military officer who was the commander of this particular group, one of the contentions by the deliverer was that once L.A. law enforcement began to perceive that O.J. Simpson was a suspect, that there would be a rush to judgment, and that both the DA's office and the cops would not only disregard evidence pointing in the other direction, but it was the suspicion and the prediction of the deliverer that elements within law enforcement would further manufacture false evidence in order to frame O.J. Simpson. And the presentation by Skinner here contends that that is exactly what happened. Continuing here with Skinner's account. Quote, "I'll answer that in a minute, but first some important news. A couple of days ago, I received word from the generals that they approved one of the deliverer's ideas that will now..." That's the segment that I just read you. I might as well read this again. "I'll answer that in a minute, but first some important news. A couple of days ago, I received word from the generals that they approved of one of the deliverer's ideas that will now turn the whole trial around. There are tapes of Detective Mark Furman describing how much he hates niggers and how he and other LAPD officers, as a matter of course, planted evidence in prior cases. We have leaked to the defense the existence of these tapes. If the defense can get their hands on these tapes, you'll see all hell break loose in a couple of weeks. The generals are convinced that this will drive an even bigger wedge between the races, inflaming both communities. The whites won't believe it. They'll see it as just another attack by the nigger lovers, while the hip-hop and black sambles will see the tapes as justifying what they've always known. The cops have stacked the deck against them and theirs. No questions, gentlemen. I'm not at liberty to say anything more. Besides, I don't know nothing. There then follows the reference to the police further manufacturing false evidence against O.J. Simpson. By the way, the reference here to Colby, C-O-L-B-Y, is a reference to the code name of a member of this team who was a blood and DNA specialist who obtained for them a sample of O.J. Simpson's blood. More about that later. And skipping down, we read, quote, "When you work with blood, as Colby did, you learn some of the things the forensic people look for," stated the enforcer. He went over Skinner's explanation again in more detail. Quote, "A cardboard tube is inserted into each sock. Holding each sock by the tube end, the atomizer is used to spray the solution of blood and water onto the socks. Each sock is positioned with the lower part of the sock toward the atomizer nozzle to duplicate blood splashing up from footsteps. As the tubes are removed, there is always the possibility that one of the tubes can have an excess of blood on it from seepage through the sock. Potentially, some of this blood could get onto the inside of the sock as the tube is removed. This may cause a slight smear on the sock, like the one the prosecution's got. Whoever performed the plant was sloppy. It definitely wasn't us," unquote. So again, the contention here is that it was not members of a cause of this elite strike team in Operation Thunderbolt that performed the planting of the blood on the socks. And again, the prediction by the deliverer was that once it became apparent, or once it appeared to the DA's office and the police themselves that O.J. was a suspect, that there would be a rush to judgment. The DA's office would overlook evidence pointing in other directions, and that the cops would very possibly further manufacture evidence against O.J. Simpson. And as we will see, the role of the Trojan horse, the dark German, again, the L.A. law enforcement insider, who was part of Operation Thunderbolt, was to direct the operation, direct the investigation into the direction of, or in the direction of, O.J. Simpson. By the way, I want to point out that the archive shows to which I've alluded are still available from Archives on Audio. Their address is P.O. Box 170023, Box 17-0023, that is in San Francisco, zip code 94117, 94117-0023. Their phone number is 415-346-1840. There's also a 20-page catalog listing all of the archive shows, cross-referencing the broadcast with other programs containing similar or related material. The half-hour segments, by the way, as well as the weekly One Step Beyond shows that I do on my home base station, KFJC-FM, are not available from Archives on Audio. The half-hour segments and the weekly One Step Beyond shows are only available from an outfit called Spitfire. That's Spitfire. Their address is P.O. Box 1179, P.O. Box 1179, that is in Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, California. The zip code is 95005. They also have an email address. The email address for Spitfire is alcalame at ix.netcom.com. Once again, that's alcalame at ix.netcom.com. Before concluding this segment, I also want to mention, people have frequently asked me when I was going to begin doing some writing or have something out in print. I'm in the process of launching my own political journal. It hopefully will begin publication before too much longer. I can't discuss it in any detail because I will be getting money from that, hopefully, knock knock. However, people that would like to inquire about that can write to the following address, Box 191710. Box 191710, that's in San Francisco, California, zip code 94119-94119-1710. By the way, the publication is entitled Other Means. It comes from the quote from Prussian military theoretician Karl von Clausewitz, that war is the continuation of politics by other means. And again, other means can be contacted at Box 191710. That is in San Francisco, zip code 94119-1710. Or you can contact me via email at demory, D-E-M-O-R-Y, at well.com. That's D-E-M-O-R-Y at well.com. That concludes this particular segment. In our next segment, we're going to take a look at not only the unnamed foreign terrorist group, probably a German Nazi group from the context, but that's not established, and also the Trojan horse or horses, the white supremacist officers within the L.A. legal system, who were a vital component of Operation Thunderbolt, the code name for this Nazi psyop performed by this particular group, identified by Skinner as codenamed Cause, C-A-U-S-E. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.
Opinions expressed on KFJC are not necessarily those of its staff or management. Responsible parties with opposing views may be given time to air those views. For more information, write to the Public Affairs Director at KFJC, 12345 El Monte Road, Los Altos Hills, California, 94022.
We are orchestra.